This is the Inland Journal. I'm Doug Nadvornik. This week marks the end of the 40-day National Poor People's Campaign. The program is a revival of the work done by Martin Luther King during the last months of his life. For 6 weeks, people in communities all over the U.S., such as Liz Moore in Spokane, have been holding rallies and drawing attention to issues such as poverty and racism. Moore is one of the three chair people for the Washington State Poor People's Campaign. Last Thursday evening, she spoke at a gathering in the plaza next to Spokane City Hall.
The goal of this 40 days, this season of moral resistance, is to shift the narrative so that instead of party-based talking points and tweets being how we discuss what's wrong with this country, we can talk about the real lives of people surviving poverty, systemic racism, the war economy, and ecological devastation. And that narrative is firmly entrenched. It is a hard thing to budge. And we know for sure that if there were a small group of right-wing folks doing what's been happening in 30 state capitals, it'd be all over the news, right? But it's not the same. It's not the same. So what it takes is, what it always takes, is persistence and guts and stick-to-itiveness and spine and feet and hands and hearts together.
For the last 5 Mondays, Moore has arranged road trips for Spokane people who wanted to participate in the rallies on the state capitol steps in Olympia.
I particularly want to thank all the folks who have donated so that we can provide gas money and so that we can cover food stipends for folks that would not be able to participate otherwise. Whether that's donating $5 or $50, your support has meant that folks can be there in Olympia to speak their own stories that would not be able to be there otherwise.
Among those who spoke their stories was Andrea Rose Gallardo. Drea Rose, as she's known, is a Native and Latina woman who grew up in poverty on the Spokane Indian Reservation.
I felt like I've been the voice for the Native Americans in this Poor People campaign, so I just hope that that we look out for the reservations too, because the conditions growing up there, it's hard.
Drea Rose works with renters as part of an organization called the Tenants Union.
We're advocates. We give information to tenants if they receive letters from their landlord that they don't understand or they may not agree with, and they don't know what to do. We can counsel them and give them the right tools, the right forms to send their landlords. A lot of us don't know our rights, and we're getting screwed over by landlords because we don't know the rights, and they know the law.
She says people are worried about their lack of security.
Poverty can happen to anybody. Everybody's one accident, one incident away from poverty. I hear it all the time of stories where, they got in a car wreck, had to miss work that made them lose their job, and then they can't pay their rent. Boom, they're on the streets. This is, it's a ripple effect. It could happen to anybody. Nobody's really protected right now.
Another woman who has told her story in Olympia is Shelley McClellan. Recently, she lived 3 months in her car in Spokane, another 6 months in shelters. She blames her physical and mental disabilities for some of that, and she credits her stay at the Union Gospel Mission with helping her to find a church, to meet other women in similar situations, and to find some self-esteem she'd been lacking. For now, the trend in her life is up, but even that is fragile.
Through Frontier Behavioral Health, I was able to get a Section 8 voucher. And so I got a brand new apartment right down the street from my church. And so my cat and I are very happy there. I've been waiting 2 years and 2 months for disability to go through. So I've been living on $197 a month for, I guess a little over a year.
So how do you manage on that?
You don't. I don't. I pay my rent is $100 a month because of the voucher. And my cat's medicine is $35. And then after paying her food and cat litter, there's nothing left over for me. And that's the way it is. I love her so much that it's worth it. So the food banks in Spokane are great. So it's really hard to run out of food. I've been relying on people and friends for transportation because my car was stolen in March.
So you're here with the Poor People's Campaign. Tell me what this particular campaign means to you.
As I got to know the women at the shelter, and I've met people that are sleeping out on the streets, and I see the commonality that we all have. We're all brave, generous, funny, courageous, giving people full of love. One of the things that I think is so poignant about being homeless is you spend a lot of your energy trying to be invisible because you know you're not wanted. At 3 o'clock in the morning when you're trying to find just a place to pee and all the restrooms are locked to you, when you haven't had gas money to, you know, to go to a place to get a shower or food or anything, and you're just so low on energy and you're scraggly and you feel gross, all you want to do is slink in and find a bathroom. You don't want anybody to look at you.
So you at least have a home now. Has it changed the way you approach your life, or is it all the same as it was when you were homeless?
Oh, it's so much, everything is so much easier. I can take a shower whenever I want to. It's great. I can go to bed. I can sleep if I get a cold. When you're homeless and you're sick, you're constantly, you know, moving. Throughout the day, at a certain time of day, you're sort of allowed to be here. You can't stay anywhere for too long. You outlive your welcome. Now I can sit and I can do computer programming. We're studying website design. I can make plans. I can prepare for the future. Now I'm going to be getting disability in July. So now I'm planning. Oh, now I've got these tomatoes starts that I've been starting on my balcony. I can put those in a pot. I can take my cat to the vet. I can pay for a class just because I want to take that class. Oh my gosh, I'll get to go out to eat maybe once or twice a month. I haven't been out to eat in so long. I'll be able to buy toilet paper. I'm so happy about buying toilet paper and cat litter and the stupid stuff. I am really looking forward to paying my stupid electric bill. I don't like that Snap Energy has to pay my electric bill for me. I want to pay my own electric bill. I'm going to replace my car. I'll have freedom. I'm sorry.
Shelley McClellan's is one of thousands of stories of poverty of people in the inland Northwest. She's a participant in the Spokane version of the Poor People's Campaign. At least one, maybe a few more, Spokane residents will travel to the National Mall in Washington, D.C. on June 23rd for a Stand Against Poverty rally and moral revival. Medical education is undergoing a renaissance in the inland Northwest. For years, the University of Washington controlled medical education opportunities in the 5-state region consisting of Washington, Wyoming, Alaska, Montana, and Idaho. It had the only med school in the region, allowing first-year students from those states to study close to home before recalling them to Seattle. Now, Washington State University, focused on Washington students, has its own medical school, with its second class about to start in August. And the privately funded Idaho College of Osteopathic Medicine in Meridian will welcome its first class in September. But medical school is only half of the doctor training equation. The other half is the mandatory postgraduate training, known as residency, which is required before doctors can practice on their own. Many believe it is the more important factor in determining whether doctors will stay in the region after their training is complete. The UW operates a wide range of residency programs, and now WSU is getting into the action. 2 weeks ago, its Board of Regents endorsed a recommendation by College of Medicine founding Dean John Tomkowiak to allow the university to pursue its own residency programs.
It's really a continuum of the mission that we are on to train future healthcare providers to meet the needs of the state, particularly in rural and underserved areas. And what we know for physicians is that many of them will end up practicing within about a 100-mile radius of where they finish their residency. That number is increased by if they also do their medical school in the same state. So we have the first part of that equation with the LCNS Floyd College of Medicine. And now we need to build the second part, which is the residency programs associated with the college.
Now one Idaho state senator is calling on her state to expand its residency opportunities. Idaho already has several programs, mostly in the southern part of the state. There's also a family medicine residency in Coeur d'Alene. Democrat Michelle Stennett, who represents South Central Idaho, thinks more programs, especially in rural hospitals, will help to attract more doctors to the Gem State.
We're ranked 49th in the nation on the amount of doctors, amount of active physicians per capita that we have in Idaho. And about 27% of them are over the age of 60 and will retire out in the next decade. And what's concerning for those of us who live in rural Idaho particularly is many of those areas are already at a deficit for the amount of doctors or even medical facilities that service people. For my area, as an example, Lincoln County has had one doctor who's been the doctor for the entire county for 33 years, and he's retiring. Camas County, another one of my counties, has a visiting physician once a week, but has no medical facility to speak of within the county. I know up in northern Idaho, that is also of concern. There are a few primary care facilities, what they call community hospitals, like Benoit has a 19-bed facility, and Bonner, 24-bed facility, and Boundary, a 20-bed facility, but none of that adequately services the population. And there are many counties that have either a rotating physician intermittently or have no real medical services to speak of. And this is very concerning because we are the fastest growing state in the nation right now.
Is the state of Idaho covered then well enough by medical schools to start with?
No, I don't think that I could say that we have adequately done that at all. I'm pleased to see that we are doing more than we have historically, but there is a far bigger demand than what we have in place at the moment. And so there is has been a plan that was put out by Idaho's general medical educator. He's a coordinator, and he put out a 10-year strategic plan that is asking the state of Idaho to put $16 million forward to implement this plan over the next 10 years. And what that will do is increase the amount of, by about 50 to 70% of the residencies within Idaho. And that will service a greater area, usually about a 100-mile radius, ends up improving the medical services that are offered. What's beneficial for that $16 million is it has an estimated economic impact on the state of $1.3 billion in revenue coming in and 10,000 new jobs. So it's a quite a broad plan that we just barely started this last session to put a very small amount of money in, but can dramatically change the amount of investment, of jobs, and also hundreds of new doctors that will be able to put into the system in Idaho.
In the state of Washington, most of them, and there are about 1,700 medical residency seats in Washington, 95% in along the I-5 corridor, and the others in Yakima and Spokane. How would you split out the medical residencies in Idaho in terms of putting them in different places up and down the state?
Well, of course, most of our doctors are sitting in higher urban areas, Boise, Meridian, Eagle, that area, and to a lesser degree, out in Idaho Falls and Twin Falls and up in Kootenai County in Coeur d'Alene. But there is vast medical deserts in our state that are far from any decent services and travel long distances. This impacts not only our our residents and population, our constituencies, but also veterans. There's very poor outreach programs to our veteran population. So I think that we may have, they're pressured because I even understand up in Kootenai, many people use your Spokane facilities and the large medical facility in Coeur d'Alene, but the amount of time it takes for you to see a doctor can be months. And so even in those places that have larger centers, they're tapped to capacity. There needs to be a plan in place where we're looking long-term, especially with a third of our doctor population retiring out in this same next decade, about how we can make that much more even across the state, because right now it's only in pockets of the state.
And how high on the legislative priority list do you think this issue is?
Well, given that the current governor, who is now retiring, did not put near as much as what was requested by this plan, and even with the Joint Finance Committee, it doubled it, it only put about a few million dollars aside. So that's only a small portion of what was asked for. I think as we look ahead, which unfortunately sometimes governments are not speedy about If we continue to grow at the pace we are, with the number of retirees moving in, population growth, and this ever-diminishing pool of doctors on an ever-increasing demand, I think the pressure on the legislature, because most of us are, many of us are rural legislators, we will start to understand how critical the need is. It's also teaching our colleagues about the importance and how we can do this and how the investment will be a good investment, because the outcomes will be so worth the original investment, not only monetarily, but in jobs, but also services to our people.
Michelle Stannett is a Democratic state senator from Ketchum, Idaho. When a wildfire ignites and firefighters are called to put it out, they not only bring the equipment they need to battle the fire, they also bring a whole logistical system to take care of their personal needs. Sometimes on the big fires, that support system becomes quite an operation. You can get a sense of what that looks like this week at Deer Park High School, north of Spokane. It's been turned into a mock wildfire camp, a place where nearly 400 wildland firefighters and 100 or so instructors and support people are preparing for the summer wildfire season. Gina Sears is the district ranger for the Forest Service offices in Newport and Sullivan Lake. But this week she's also learning how to work with reporters who cover wildfires. She walks us around the converted fire campus. Ahead of us on the baseball field, clusters of domed pup tents pop up from the green of the outfield.
The sleeping area has been identified out here. We have a group called the logistics folks or facilities, and they set up where the sleeping areas are. Whenever there's inmate crews, there's kind of a separate sleeping area.
There are porta potties and hand washing areas, an extensive kitchen, and a mess tent. You can hear the hum of the generators powering machines that help to run that kitchen and even a shower facility.
And there's about 6 or 7 small stalls in that shower unit. Nobody brings bath towels, right? So we use big paper, large paper towels that are kind of 6x4 or something like that. You take a couple of those and you dry off and dry your hair and whatnot, and then you throw it and then it gets thrown away.
On longer fires, Sears says the agencies sometimes hire a laundry service to wash clothes for the firefighters. Inside the high school, the firefighters neatly stack their helmets and other equipment along the walls next to the classrooms where they spend a good part of their days. In one of the rooms, fabric boxes filled with sand sit on tabletops.
This is scenario and role-playing. So you get a crew together and have a lead on the table who's a very experienced firefighter usually. So they set up scenarios, and there's various things that are meaningful here. This typically is like a stream. They would have roads, would have where the vegetation is. And then the trainees would have kind of a crew boss or a crew leader, and then their crew members, and then they would use this to role play that situation.
More than a dozen agencies have sent their people here for training. Gina Sears says many are young people on their first rotations who are just learning the basics.
So you have to take these 100 level classes before you can take, just kind of like in college, the 200 level, the 300 level classes. And those get documented in a way that we call a red card. So a red card is that certification of the skills that you are able to do on a fire situation. For instance, there are three levels of chainsaw operators. There's the very basic level, there's a medium level, and then there's a very highly skilled level that can assess a very dangerous type of tree and determine whether or not they have the skills to even drop it.
One of the skills taught here is how to deploy your shelter when the fire gets too close. It's the nuclear option, the last resort for a wildland firefighter.
The fire shelter has been required equipment for wildland firefighters since the 1970s. Since that time, shelters have saved hundreds of lives and prevented hundreds of serious burn injuries. If entrapped in a wildfire, shelters are used to provide some protection from the fire's heat and smoke.
After watching a video, groups grab containers the size of small shoeboxes. These boxes hold the tightly wrapped shelters. The participants in this case, reporters invited for the day, head outside to practice. The goal for firefighters is to unwrap the shelters and then cocoon their bodies in them within 30 seconds. Sears says the training will continue here at Deer Park through the weekend. Firefighters will be taken Saturday to a controlled burn site for a simulated fire.
And so they will be crewed up into, I believe, into like 20-person crews, and they'll be given an assignment to learn how to put into practice their line-building skills, their communication skills, their safety knowledge. That's all putting into practice on Saturday.
Others will be cycling through the facility for the next several days, some staying only a few hours to learn more specialized skills. When they're finished, the men and women here will be called to go all over the region and perhaps to other parts of the country and spend their summer in fire camps just like this one. The deepening drought in eastern Oregon is causing some tension between neighbors. It's over how to share the dwindling supply of water for their fields and cattle, and the antiquated way that the water is shared in the West doesn't help, as correspondent Anna King explains.
This cowboy hat-clad couple has been roping and riding together for 37 years.
I'm Keith Belzor.
I'm Katie Belzor.
And we ranch just south of Burns, Oregon in Harney County.
They run about 300 head of Angus mother cows over hundreds of acres of their land and thousands of acres of leased public rangeland. Their operation really depends on snowpack. The melting water comes down the mountain into the Sylvie's River and then gets diverted into ditches, sloughs, and fields. That gives cattle something to drink, but it also grows hay and pasture grass for them to eat. And for the Belzors, this short water year hurts.
You got to be a little bit of a gambler, I guess, because you're going to have good years and you're going to have not so good years.
These ranchers shouldn't really be worried about water. They have what's called a senior water right. That means they own a share of water that flows into this basin. Their share dates back to 1886, so it gives them one of the front spots in line. But the drought this year is so bad that even with a senior water right, they can't get enough. The water originates far away from their farm, and much of it is used up before it even gets to them. It's kind of an honor system. Neighbors have to cooperate to divvy up the water. Sometimes that doesn't happen.
We're fortunate we have some really good neighbors that work well with us and communicate. And then unfortunately, you know, there's some that just put boards in and do not want to let water come on through, even if they have the same rights priority date that we do. And that can be a frustration.
Dealing with that frustration is Dally Swindlehurst. He's standing on the Sylvie's River, which feeds the whole basin below.
It can be challenging sometimes.
Swindlehurst is the East Region Assistant Water Manager for the state of Oregon. He's a big guy with a calm voice. His territory runs from Washington to Nevada. But most of his time is sopped up in dry Harney County, where the challenge is there are no reservoirs, just snowpack and storms.
Last year we had a really good snow year. We got most everybody water that needed water, but the years before that we were in a drought, and this year again we're in drought.
It doesn't help that this is a very leaky system. The water off the Sylvie's River isn't put into metal pipes. Water sloshes around in open ditches and scatters across fields. The ground acts like a thirsty sponge. Water can be absorbed before it gets to its intended destination. Keith Belzor says the short water season might cost him $37,000 on lost hay. He says this leaky system could be modernized, but
I hope that it never is.
He says to pipe everything and create a tight system.
At this point, the amount of money it would take to do that would probably break most places.
And there is a beautiful benefit to all the complicated water woes of Harney County. Thousands of migratory birds stop over in this part of Oregon on their way north or south. The waterfowl munch the tender spring crop shoots and ply the old sloughs. The Belzors are glad they're here. I'm Anna King outside of Burns, Oregon.
Inland Journal is Spokane Public Radio's weekly public affairs program. You can find our programs and stories on the Inland Journal page at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Download a podcast of the program as well. Direct your comments to Inland Journal at KPBX.org or call our listener comment line at 509-232-6904. Next week, we're scheduled to speak live with Spokane Mayor David Condon. Spokane Public Radio is listener-supported, made possible through your contributions. Thank you for your support. I'm Doug Nadvornik.